Maybe I just expect too much. Maybe all the answers come up wrong. You keep on telling me be patient, but I know I don't belong. Seems like I'm always an outsider. Like to be remembered as a friend. It's a window on my childhood. The clatter of the rain. Is there something that we're missing? Something we should know? Can you tell me a good reason why we sell our souls? Now I'm sealed for your protection, self-righteous till the end. There's a cold fear inside me that will turn out just like them. Field town road construction, down to one lane. Moving forward slowly, there's credit to be paid.
I want to be with the people who are submerged and work in the row, who submerge in the task, who go into the fields to harvest and work in a row and pass the bags along, who stand in the line and haul in their places, who are not parlor generals or field deserters, but move in a common rhythm when the food must come in or the fire be put out. The work of the world is common as mud. Botched, it smears the hands and crumbles to dust. But the thing worth doing well done has a shape that satisfies, clean and evident. Greek amphoras for wine or oil, Hopi vases that held corn are put in museums, but you know they were meant to be used. The pitcher cries for water to carry and a person for work that is real. Well, this church reminds me of my grandfather's church. He was a Methodist minister, and I would often play. I was supposed to be cleaning the sanctuary, and I'd often play at the preaching. So I'm sort of feeling like I'm hiding up here. But that's right. And I'm from South Carolina, so if you all feel like wooing at any point, that will help me. It'll make me feel more comfortable. Woo! this sermon is about four examples of social witness, and some of these people you'll know and some of these people you may not know. But the point of this sermon is not that they were amazing and wonderful and came out of the womb as great organizers or great world changers. The point of the sermon is how they're so like us. And the first person I want to talk about is Mary Harris, and y'all may know her as Mother Jones. And Mother Jones came from Cork, Ireland. Her father was an Irish tenant farmer. He was Catholic. And they were starving to death. So they went to Toronto when she was a very small girl. And she went to school to be a teacher. That was a very respectable, big move up, really, from where she came from. And she learned to be a teacher. She graduated and moved down to teach at a convent school in Michigan. And then she went down to Memphis to teach school and met a man named George Jones, who was a joiner and in the union, and had four children with him very quickly. But about 1867, there was a yellow fever epidemic right after the Civil War in Memphis, and her husband and her four children, who were all under five, died. And then she didn't know what to do, so she went back up to Chicago, where she'd been a dressmaker at one time, and she started a little shop, and she was doing pretty well. She was sewing for the rich people there on Lakeshore Drive. And in 1871, they had a big fire. You know, Mrs. O'Leary's cow kicked the lantern over. And she got wiped out in that fire, everything she had, her shop, her house. She didn't know what to do. So here's this widow woman. She's, you know, almost 40. Has nothing. So what she did was she went to the Knights of Labor Union Hall, her husband's old union hall, and that's when she became an organizer. So she spent the next 30 years having people try to kill her and talk bad about her, and she was extremely effective as an organizer. During the period she was working, as the early late 1800s, early 1900s, and of course women couldn't vote. And she looked older than she was. She'd had a hard life, and she was only about this tall. But she would dress in grandmotherly clothes, and she lied about her age and said she was 20 years older than she was. It's true. And so a lot of times the UMW or the socialists would ask her to go in to help with a strike that was failing. And often the organizers that they send in, the male organizers, would be murdered on their way in. They'd get them on the train and then throw them off the train. But she looked like everybody's grandmother. It was really hard to be mean to her. But they were very afraid of her. In fact, in the Senate, they said, "You, madam, are the grandmother of all agitators." And she said, "I hope, to be the great-grandmother of all agitators." I'm going to sing you a song about her. But the thing I want you to take home about her is that she took all her tragedy and transcended it. She found a way to use what she had and what people were using against her to further the cause. She became the mother, and she lost all those children, and she became the mother of all the minors. And she was very effective at organizing the women and children. And the song I'm going to sing you about is about the Arno, Pennsylvania strike of 1900.
True story. If you want to read more about Mother Jones, her autobiography that she wrote, so it's a little bit PR, but it's online. It's free. This song's called Dishpan Brigade. Now old Mary Harris was 5 feet tall, gray hair and eyes and Irish blue. And she buried her husband, four little ones. Now the Union was all she knew. And she'd stand up to an accompany gun. If there was a fight, she was home. And the breaker boys and the silk mill girls called her Mother Jones. Well, J.P. Morgan owned the Dripmouth mine. He paid $1.35 a day. 12 to 14 hours, 6 days a week. Yeah, that was a company way. But anthracite coal is a hard, hard coal. It burns so clean and true. And it burns off the dreams of a miner soul and the blood of the UMW. Oh, Mother cried out, shame, shame, shame. We've nothing to lose but our chain. And many a miner's life's been saved by a dishpan brigade. Now there's a place in the next verse where she's talking to the miners, and of course she didn't have a microphone, so it sounded like this.
Will you be slaves or be men?
Like that. So, I know. I'm really a shy person, but I've been talking about Mother Jones now for a couple of years, and suddenly, you know, it's like my little saint Mother Jones is behind you going... So, if you would like to get in touch with your inner Mother Jones saint, you can stand up and say, will you be slaves or be men? It's very empowering. I suggest it. Okay. The strikers held out 4 long months, hard bread and coffee every day. Between the scabs and the guns or the Pinkertons, their courage was slipping away. So the Union called in Mother Jones. She said, will you be slaves or be men? And she told all the women to meet up at dawn and they'll go to that lion's den. So the women marched to that Dripmouth mine with their dishpans, mops, and brooms. And the sheriff said, now, you go back home. I'm afraid you'll upset the mules. But an angry woman knocked that sheriff down. She said, the heck with the mules and with you. And they chased those scabs all the way back to town. And that strike was almost through. Oh, Mother cried out, shame, shame, shame. We've nothing to lose but our chains. And many a worker's life's been saved by a dishpan brigade. So the women kept watch every night with their babies in their arms. And the Union won the Arno strike, and not a soul was harmed. And Mother traveled another 30 years where there was a fight, she was home. And the breaker boys and the silk mill girls called her Mother Jones. Thank you. Well, there's a lot of really interesting things about Mother Jones, and I want to keep bringing this up. Like, not everything she thought was right. I mean, she was against suffrage. She thought it distracted women from the real struggle, which was class struggle. And there were a number of other things, but she was a good, she was a little bit a left of center, and it made the center a better place. You can thank her every time you work an 8-hour day instead of a 14-hour day.
She led a children's march to Teddy Roosevelt's summer house. And it didn't work. But it got so much press across the country that it really led to an outpouring of child labor laws and for the 8-hour workday. So she did a lot of good that we can thank her for, besides looking really good on the front of Mother Jones magazine. The next person I want to talk about is also somebody that you probably know a lot about, Martin Luther King Jr. He was a preacher's son, grew up in Atlanta. He actually sang in the choir at the Gone with the Wind debut at the Fox Theater in Atlanta with his church choir when he was a boy in 1938. And then he was under a lot of pressure to do well. His father was a very successful minister, and he went to college early. He graduated. He went to college when he was 16, went to Moorhead. And then he went up and got his Bachelor's of Divinity in Pennsylvania. And then he got his doctorate. And while he was working on his doctorate, he got his first church in Montgomery, Alabama, Dexter Avenue Baptist Church. And the NAACP was very active there working on the early stirrings of the civil rights movement. And he met a couple of guys who were very influential in his thinking, but he later distanced himself from. One was Bernard Ruskin, who was homosexual and very out about it. And Dr. King distanced himself later from him. So not everything he did was wonderful. Another thing that's real interesting is he got his first church there. And the NAACP was really trying to find a test case where they could take on that bus segregation thing. And so, of course, we all know the Rosa Parks story in 55, but what you don't know, perhaps, is that in 1953, a very similar case came up with a 16-year-old girl, and I forget her name sometimes. Yeah, Claudette Colvin, who was 15. But she wasn't this perfect representative. You know, she wasn't a Jackie Robinson. So it wasn't a perfect situation. So they passed that one by 2 years earlier. And Dr. King had just got his church. He was a new minister. Y'all have a pretty new minister. You know what that's like. She has a lot to think about and a lot of things to organize. And he had a lot of people in his parish and he had a lot of people to take care of. And he just didn't want to get involved. It wasn't until they tried to blow up his house and his children that it got a little bit more intense. So I encourage you to read the story. While he is a very saintly, amazing person and has done great things, and I highly admire him, I think it's important that we all read the backstories of these people because they're just like us. Maybe you just couldn't do it that week. You couldn't go to the meeting that week, and you couldn't stand up. Or you couldn't show up and put out flyers, and you didn't have an extra $5 for the campaign that week. It doesn't mean that next week you can't do it. It doesn't mean that you can't make a difference when your chime comes. So I don't think we need to beat ourselves up all the time. Being Unitarian is very stressful that way. I mean, we have all these great role models of Susan B. Anthony's and, you know, Thoreau's, and it's hard to think, oh, yeah, well, I'm one too. I write a couple songs, you know. But this song I'm going to sing you, I wrote with a friend of mine from Natchez, Mississippi, and we were comparing notes about the day that Dr. King got killed. I was only 8. And he was a similar age. And we watched our parents and everyone around us freak out. And then about a week after I was talking to him, I was in a bar. And I heard this girl telling the story about what her family did in the riots in Detroit on that night. And I started thinking, how could a peaceful man cause such an uproar? And I got the song out of it. And in this song, you need to be some well-dressed backup singers. Your part goes, hoo, hoo. You can do it. I believe in you. Driving past the rain in Memphis, my mind flashed back to the screen. A dark form crashing to the ground and the people around him screaming. My grandmother was standing behind me. I heard her say, well, it's about time. And my grandma is a real good woman. How could she want that man to die? Tanks and Natchez. Governors called out the National Guard. Good people, black and white. How can you make your heart so hard?
the suburbs near Detroit City. They're talking riots in the streets. So you hide your kids behind the sofa, eat your dinner with a shotgun, cross your knees. Tanks and hatches, ooh, governor's called out the national guard. Good people, black and white, how can you make your heart so hard? Heard it said he was a loudmouth troublemaker, but Reverend King was a family man. You never heard him threaten anybody. You never saw a gun in his hand. I can't find no real deliverance in hate preachers like the Ku Klux Klan. They never helped raise up a spirit. They never loved their fellow man. Tanks in Natchez. Governors called out the National Guard. Good people, black and white, can't you tell me what you're so scared of? Tanks in Natchez. Governors called out the National Guard. Good people, black and white, how can you make your heart so hard?
Thank you.
Well, this next person you may not know about. These next two stories are much more current. This person, I heard this story from Holly Neer, and many people have done art relating to this story, but this is the story of Vedran Smolovic, and he was a cellist of Sarajevo. A novel just came out about the story, which he isn't very happy about, but he comes from a very long line of musicians from Sarajevo, and he was in his 40s. He's my age, a little bit older. And he's a cellist in the opera there. And when the Civil War happened and the siege of Sarajevo was going on, everybody was staying in their apartment. Nobody was going out on the streets. People were shooting. There were bombs. There were a lot of mortars going off. And so he's in his apartment, and his apartment faced the only bakery that was still open in town. So every morning people would line up to get bread. And one morning he's having his coffee looking out the window, and there's 22 people in line, and a mortar hits and kills them all in front of him. So this is the part that's amazing. He got up the next day and he put his tuxedo on, he got his cello, and he went and got in the mortar hole. And he started playing the song by Abinoni, which was found in the remnants of Dresden when Dresden was bombed during World War II, called Adagio in G minor. And he played it every day for 22 days. And so people started talking about this crazy cellist who's playing while people are shooting all around him. And he's just sitting there playing. And it was so galvanizing that CNN and all these people showed up to interview him, and they were like, Mr. Smolovic, why are you out here playing your cello while people are bombing? And he said, why are they bombing while I'm playing my cello? I just think it's a great story. He left Sarajevo about a year after that. This is in the early 90s when this happened. And went to Northern Ireland, and he's still very active in the peace and justice movement, but in Northern Ireland. And I wrote this song for choir, so you have to imagine. You have to use your imagination. There's three parts singing and a cello and the guitar. But I'm just going to do a little bit of it before you get a feel for it. But a lot of people are doing art. So now you've heard the story. If you're an artist of some kind, do some art about this. There's actually a movement, international movement, to do art and let people know about the story. The song's called Adagio. Speak to me in Adagio. While the mortars fly, the listening dead that stood for bread, this bow can heal the sky. A prayer for peace, a prayer for peace. How can I play? How can I play?
How can I play while they bomb? But how can they bomb? How can they bomb while we play? So, when I'm writing these political kind of story songs where there's a lot of history involved, it's like researching a novel. I try and find all the images that are going to tell you the story really fast because my novel's only 4.5 minutes long. And I was doing a lot of research on the early labor movement. I was looking at photos, which there are millions of photos of the May Day parades and the early suffragettes and all that era in the National Archives. You can just go online and look at them. They're really intense. And they also have these pictures of Lewis Hines photos of children working in the textile mills in Carolinas, where I live now. And while I was doing that research, I heard the story on NPR about this factory in Mexico. This factory was all underage girls, teenagers, and 20-year-old girls, a lot of single mothers, working in this factory where they didn't pay them, and they still pay them exactly $4.68 a day to make T-shirts for 8 universities for Reebok and Nike. And one of the colleges was Carolina. Pissed me off, wrote a song about it. Here it is. Hawkers peddle T-shirts at the game for $25. You get to wear a name. I sew those shirts in Puebla, Mexico. That's the part we never really know, Carolina. $800 work at the Kundong factory. Some of them lie to say they are 15. Making shirts for Reebok and Nike, 8 universities. Carolina. $35 for a 50-hour week. When they tried to form a union, 5 were thrown out on the street. 300 workers occupied the plant. The police beat them with rubber bats. Carolina. So when the press heard about what they'd done, Nike thought they just might cut and run. Corporate profits, always the bottom line. But there's a point when profit is a crime. Walmart. Carolina. 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 Later, and a hunger strike that Maquiladora won its basic rights, just means sweatshop. The company saved its face and changed its name to Mexico. But I wonder if their colors ever change. I want to thank you for listening to me this morning. Thank you for hosting me. Everybody's been so kind. Don't think you can't do something. We've got a long tradition as Unitarians of getting things done. Don't be afraid.